Chapter 14, The Responsibility Button. The responsibility button is similar to the fix-it button in many ways, but where the fixer is concerned about his child's needs, the overly responsible parent is more concerned about her own. Responsibility becomes a button when parents take on more than their share, do too much for their children, overprotect, and then react when their children don't make them look good. They are, in fact, asking their children to give them good grades. These parents see responsibility as their job description. Instead of taking over their children's problems, they hover and nag them to get it right, patrol them to make sure they do what is expected, and overprotect them to prevent them from failing. They nag their children to brush their teeth, do their homework, and look their best. And if their children fail, the parents fail, even though that failure is projected as blame onto the child. The overly responsible parent usually believes her children cannot cope, get things done, or exist, for that matter, without her constantly telling them what to do and when to do it. Dependency is at the core of their problems. So, inadvertently, these parents raise children who either rebel and fall on their face or transfer their dependence onto others to hold them up. For overly responsible parents, their children's lives rest in their hands. It's a huge job. So when this parent's button gets pushed, she feels resentful and often reacts by controlling in an attempt to show the world what a good job she has done. The child who pushes the responsibility button is saying, "You take responsibility for yourself and teach me to take responsibility for myself." I have to keep them safe. Hannah, Paul, Eric, age 9, Cyrus, 7, and Whitney, 1. "Could we talk about fears?" Hannah asked in class one morning. "I'm afraid about everything my kids do. I'm always worried they're going to hurt themselves or get killed. I feel so responsible. I remember when I held my first baby in the hospital. I cried and said to my mother, 'I'm responsible for him.' It was overwhelming, and what makes it worse is that Paul doesn't seem to care whether they live or die the way he deals with them." "Hey, I teach them how to take care of themselves," her husband argued. "I teach them what's safe and what's not. They need to learn how to have fun, too." Hannah said that Paul thinks she's smothering them like his mother did to him, and that he's getting back at her by not focusing on their safety at all. Hannah worries that letting her boys go into the woods around their house, ride in the back of the pickup in the driveway, ride on the tractor with their dad, or leave the upstairs windows open is asking for trouble. If they leave Legos around, she's afraid Whitney will choke and die. She catastrophizes, racing to worst-case scenarios, even though as a child she spent most of her time wandering in the woods far from home. "It was my favorite thing to do, and I never got lost. I was lucky. But I could have, and my mother didn't have any idea where I was," Hannah said with a judgmental tone. I asked her what she was afraid might happen. "If I don't protect them, something terrible will happen. The other day, both boys rode their bikes down to the end of our long driveway. When they came back, they said they'd talked to a man who lives down there. I was horrified. I didn't even know they'd gone. They could have been abducted." "Is that what scares you the most?" another parent asked, "that they'll be abducted?" It's that I wasn't there to protect them," she confessed. When Hannah was 2 and her brother was 6, their father left the family. She later found out that he had served time in jail. Her stepfather moved in about 3 years later and ruled with violence. Hannah's brother Tom got the worst of it. Fearing the same, Hannah became a good girl. But she got her share of name-calling and belittling. Tom took out his aggressions on Hannah. When Hannah was 12, she and her brother were fighting at the dinner table when their stepfather pushed his chair back, threw his napkin down, and said, "That's it. I can't take it anymore. I can't live with this," and walked out. Hannah took full responsibility for making him leave and for the loss to her mother. She felt so much guilt that she had to make up a way to live with it. "I had this great fantasy that he'd gone off to buy a big, beautiful white farmhouse with animals and lots of space. I waited for him to come back and take us there, knowing we would live happily ever after," she said, still with dreamy hopefulness. After 3 weeks, he did come back. There was no house, but Hannah turned on her best behavior, convinced that she could make him stay. But he left shortly after, never to return again. "I truly believed it was all my fault," she told us. "I saved up all my babysitting money to buy my mother extravagant gifts. I did all the household jobs I wasn't even asked to do. I tried to second-guess everything my mother might need. I found out years later that my stepfather was having an affair with his secretary." Hannah laughed to downplay the irony and shame. "To make up for the abandonment of both her fathers, Hannah has to be there to protect her children. Her mission is to prove to them, unlike her father and stepfather, how much she cares, how much she is there, and how responsible she is. Hannah is taking on the responsibility for the whole family. I hate both my father and my stepfather so much. They didn't care whether I lived or died." "Men can't meet up to your standards, can they?" I asked. Hannah was silent as she realized what she had said. She saw what she was projecting onto her husband, another important man in her life. "No, I guess they can't." "So that puts an awful lot on your plate. What if you gave a little bit of the parenting responsibility to Paul?" I asked. "They'd be dead," she exclaimed. Paul rolled his eyes. She came into class the next week and said, "I read an article in a magazine about people who don't believe they deserve anything good because they're just waiting for it all to be taken away. That's me. I have a wonderful husband, wonderful children, and a wonderful house, but I can't relax because I'm so afraid it's all going to disappear. And so it's your responsibility to hold it all together, and you can't risk letting up for a second." "Right," she said. "No wonder I'm so exhausted all the time." "And no wonder you can't let the boys just have some fun," Paul added. We uncovered Hannah's childhood belief. "I am responsible for everyone abandoning me, and I have to be perfect to make up for it." Her belief in her need to be perfect sets her standard. "I have to be there to protect them at all times. If I'm not, I'm abandoning my children and showing them I don't love them." Hannah maintains her watch over her children, fearing that at any moment catastrophe will strike if she's not prepared and on her best protective behavior. "He'll be killed, he'll get lost, she'll choke and die," are all catastrophizing assumptions that lead Hannah to her exhausting vigilance and defense to prove her love and to compensate for Paul's easygoing approach. Awareness first helped Hannah bite her tongue and allow her sons a bit more freedom. She now sees the pattern she's bringing from her past and is working hard not to pass it on to her children. With self-talk, she's learning that she had nothing to do with her father and stepfather's departures and that she was dealt a raw deal. She's working with her new standard, which says, "My children are capable of handling themselves responsibly." Hannah has relaxed considerably since her work began. Although her worries are far from over, she's taking responsibility for them and not asking her boys to take care of her needs with conservative behavior. It will be important for Hannah to be realistic with her rules and not let her fears determine them. As she's growing more aware of their origin, she's able to put them aside, know they are her responsibility, and not let them interfere with her expectations of the boys. One of her sons asked if he could go on an overnight with a friend. She realized, after she had said yes, that she had not even felt the familiar tension. "I didn't catastrophize a bit," she said proudly. "I asked him to give me a call sometime while he was there, but that was it." Your report card is my report card. Carl and Tommy, age 16. Carl is the distraught parent of Tommy, an angry, frustrated, and almost lost teenager. Carl described Tommy as basically a good kid who doesn't accept responsibility, is lazy, and doesn't apply himself. Carl has many of the typical catastrophic fears of parents of teens. He'll never get a job, he'll become a drug addict, he'll get into trouble and end up in jail. Carl's fears serve to camouflage his deeper feelings of his own unworthiness, which Tommy triggers with his behavior. When Carl began classes, he listened for a few weeks before sharing with the class that Tommy was doing very poorly in school. Carl had always expected Tommy to get A's and B's because he knew he was capable of them. He had done fine in middle school. In high school, Carl had accepted his son's B's and C's, but they had since dropped to C's and D's, with a couple of F's looming. Carl felt ashamed and angry about his son's performance and let him know it. He was always on his back with nagging questions and remarks. "How much homework do you have tonight? Don't you need to get to it? How'd you manage to do so poorly on that test? You can't go out until you do your homework. How do you think you're ever going to get a job with grades like these? No son of mine is going to drop out of high school. How can you be so lazy? You're wasting whatever talent you have left." "I feel hopeless," Carl confessed. "I can't understand what's happened to Tommy. His behavior feels like a disrespectful slap in the face." Tommy had begun lying about his test grades and assignments. Carl initially began by bribing him with favors if he did well, but that brought no results. He started grounding him from baseball practice and soon from every social event in his life. Carl and his wife Sharon began arguing more and more in disagreement over Carl's punishments. Sharon wanted Carl to leave him alone, but the more she tried to prevent him from interfering, the more he interfered. Carl was convinced that his son's future was up to him and that he must act aggressively and immediately. "If I lay off, Tommy will go down the tubes. He'll never do anything worthwhile on his own. It's my responsibility to push him, isn't it?" Carl sheepishly told the class about the previous Saturday morning when Tommy had slept late. Carl was fuming, waiting for Tommy to get to his chores. All that kept him from dragging Tommy out of bed was Sharon's plea to let him sleep just this once. To appease Sharon, Carl gathered the trash to take to the dump, a job he expected Tommy to do with him. About 11:30, Tommy stumbled downstairs and was confronted by his father. Carl immediately began to lecture. "I have to confess I called him every name in the book," Carl told us. But then Tommy turned to me and said, "Fuck you, Dad," went upstairs to his room and went on a rampage. He began yelling obscenities and punched his fist through the wall in the hallway, making a big hole. Then he grabbed his backpack, pushed past me, and ran down the stairs and out the kitchen door, yelling, "Fine, you hate me? You don't have to put up with me anymore. I'm out of here." The next 2 days were a blurred nightmare for Carl and Sharon. The police were searching. Carl and Sharon had his friends searching. 2 days later, he silently appeared and locked himself in his room. He was at his girlfriend's, and all his friends had covered for him. He went to school the next day, but it was several days before he spoke to either of us. Carl hung his head and spoke softly as he relayed the details. He was now ready to hear what the group had to say. He had reached rock bottom. "What do I do?" he pleaded. Several people suggested to Carl that he had to let go of the control he was trying to maintain. Carl panicked. "He'll fall apart. He can't make it unless I push him. He'll be a failure. I'll be a failure." "Who tried to control you?" I asked him. "Huh," he laughed sarcastically. Carl was an only child. His parents had high expectations of him, but not of their marriage. He knew his mother had stayed in the marriage for him. She was desperately unhappy and hanging on by her toenails. So Carl always did his best to make her proud of him. He struggled in school, hating it almost as much as Tommy, but diligently made it through college and worked his way up to a stressful but financially secure job. Carl's father was strict and controlling. "I towed the line in order to hold my mother together and to make sure everything looked good to the outside world," Carl said. "I've followed in the footsteps of what I hated," he realized. "And now you're asking Tommy to do the same," I added. Carl's eyes grew wide. The next week he came to class and announced, "My armor will have to come off if I let go of my control. I realize that I've built this armor to protect my anger toward both my parents, and now it's protecting my anger toward Tommy, who's getting away with what I never could have. If I let down my armor, I'm afraid I'll kill him." The group rallied their support and encouraged Carl to talk about his anger. He realized that Tommy was very strong-willed and wouldn't buckle under Carl's control as Carl had under his father's. Carl's rage grew when Tommy refused to obey and accommodate the way he had. Carl came in the following week and told us that his son had announced that he wanted to quit school. Letting go seemed impossible. How can I accept this? How can I accept his terrible grades, even if he doesn't quit? What will it look like if I have a dropout for a son? Carl, it sounds like Tommy's report card is your report card, one of the group members illustrated. If he gets a D in math, you think you're getting a D in parenting. Oh, you're absolutely right. Everything clicked. I've been asking him to make it right for me so I can justify all these years of making it right for my parents, so I can finally win their approval. If I let him go, all that goes. Now what do? Nothing right now other than to stay aware of all you've discovered, I said. See what happens over the next week. Carl left that day feeling helpless. Carl had made the link. His assumptions, Tommy is lazy and incompetent and will end up in jail, provoked his rage, resulting in more attempts at control. His standard transferred directly from his past, it's my responsibility to make sure my children do their best, was unrealistic because their best was, by Carl's definition, not his children's. Carl had had to do his best for his mother and father to avoid shame and harm. Now he expected the same best from Tommy. But Tommy was a different person and didn't need what Carl needed. For Carl, a floodlight had flashed on in his head. He knew he either had to change his parenting or lose his son completely. He immediately pulled back from his nagging and shaming and shared with Tommy what he had learned about himself. The risk of letting go and allowing Tommy to take control of his own life was monumental for Carl. It resulted in Tommy dropping out of school. He's still floundering, but he has a job that he's handling responsibly. Carl had to risk Tommy making mistakes in order to hand him over responsibility for his own life. Carl is a different man. I can't believe it, he said, beaming, the last week of class. We talk to each other, Tommy listens and responds, and I'm actually supporting him in his decision the best I can. When I slip back into the familiar nag, I apologize and remind Tommy that I need a lot of practice to parent so differently, but he seems willing to give me some slack. There are plenty of times when Tommy doesn't want to be around, but we don't have outbursts of anger anymore. Carl knows that all he can do now is present opportunities. But Tommy must be in charge of what he does with those opportunities. Carl knows that Tommy's difficulties have resulted from the responsibility he took on single-handedly. If Tommy wasn't doing it right, I thought I had to make him do it right. The problem was he never cooperated with my idea of what was right. Tommy may have to fall a few times before he accepts the responsibility and knows his father won't prop him up. Carl must stand by to make sure he doesn't fall so far that he can't get up, but he must know that as with an infant learning to walk, falling is part of learning. Tommy is now free to turn his focus to himself instead of toward his resistance to his father. Carl wrote on his class evaluation, "Tommy pushed me to the edge. Instead of losing control, I learned what he was trying to teach me all along, that he needed to be trusted with his own life. It means a whole new approach, but it gives me permission and freedom to be more loving. Our relationship is now something I never thought possible." I just want to make it all better. Jennifer and Alex, age 6. I think I do a pretty good job of listening to Alex and reflecting his feelings, but it just seems to make it worse. He keeps going on and on until I'm sick of listening to it. The other day I told him his friend couldn't stay for dinner. He started screaming and calling me a meanie. I said very patiently that I understood he was mad and that he had a right to be. I didn't even add a but to it. He stomped off, still telling me how mean I was and was crabby all through dinner. I finally lost it and yelled at him to stop being such a brat and that he couldn't get his way all the time. Jennifer was frustrated that her new effective listening skill did not appear to be working with Alex. "What do you expect to happen?" I asked her. I want him to get over it. I want to make it better. You're on the right track, but you're still taking responsibility for fixing Alex's problem. You want and expect your listening skill to resolve the situation the way you want it resolved, for him to be done and happy. Can you see how strong your agenda is to have the outcome that you want? I asked. When you think it's your job to make it all better, then Alex believes that too. He will keep at it until you do make it better. When you can trust him to handle his own feelings, he will, and he will learn to trust himself as well. I could see the wheels turning in her head. What was it like in your house when you were little? How were your feelings handled? I asked. Jennifer began, I was the youngest of four and kind of left on my own. What did you most want from your mother? Well, it wasn't that I wanted more attention, I don't think. It was just that I wished she cared more about me, Jennifer offered. There were nods from the rest of the group. So I wonder if you're compensating for the lack of care you got from your mother by taking on the responsibility of all of Alex's bad feelings. Maybe you're trying too hard to give Alex what your mother didn't give you, and you're afraid it's not working. Tears started to fill her eyes. Exactly, she said. Jennifer recalled an evening at the dinner table when she was about 8. There was always commotion with 6 family members in their small kitchen. She had presented a project at school that day and had received praise from her teacher. She kept trying to tell her parents about it, but something always got in the way. Jenny, can't this wait? I have to get everyone fed, she remembered her mother saying impatiently. When she tried her father with no success, her mother piped in, Jennifer, your father has had a long, hard day. He doesn't have time for your foolishness. Leave him alone. The word foolishness rang in her ears. Jennifer tried to hold in her hurt all through dinner. When she was asked something, she whined, I don't know. Her mother said, well, if you're not going to be pleasant at the table, you can just go to your room. The event, and others like it, left a deep wound. Jennifer did not feel heard by her parents. She came away with the belief, I don't count. What happens to me is not important. She shared very little about her life with either of her parents after that. I kept everything in because I always thought that if I ever cried or got sad or angry, I'd make people mad and they wouldn't like me. Jennifer approached her parenting with the standard, I will make sure my child is heard so he will be happy. But hearing him and making him happy are two very different things. Now Jennifer was caught. Consciously, she wanted to be there for Alex, to listen to how he felt, but she had never experienced that kind of compassion and didn't know how to do it. So when she learned the skill of listening and reflecting his feelings, she had a hard time putting it into practice. She thought she had to make his bad feelings go away. When that didn't happen, she tensed up, and her acceptance and compassion disappeared. She came in the next week feeling better. I think I'm getting it, she said. The other day, Alex was having a fit about not getting a third cookie. This time, I said, Alex, you're really mad that I won't let you have another cookie. I can really understand how you feel, and you can cry about it as long as you need to. I'll be right here if you need me. And then I sat down on the other side of the room and just waited. Normally, I probably would have either given him the cookie to make him happy or not given it to him but been riddled with guilt. He kept on crying, but I felt detached. I didn't have to stop it. Even though I was detached, at the same time, I felt more involved than ever. Soon he finished his crying and then came over and asked me to read him a book. Jennifer had learned that she couldn't express herself to her parents without deep hurt and feelings of unworthiness. She was determined that her son would not feel the same, but wanting him to feel the happiness she had wished for got mixed up with her duties and responsibilities as a mother. She needs to see that her parents were not responsible for her unhappiness. They were responsible for the things they said and did to her. She's not responsible for her son's happiness, only for what she says and does.